Okay, in our next session here, Joe Levitt and I are going to kind of review the new rule, kind of give it a bottled water spin, a little more specific, and let you know how that it's going to impact us in the bottled water industry. So let me go ahead and get started. By the way, I'm not sure if everyone knows Joe Levitt. I didn't introduce myself because everybody knows me, but Joe Levitt is our outside counsel from Hogan Lovells. He had 25 years with CFSAN, FDA at CFSAN. So Joe is a veteran of the food industry and has adapted very well to bottled water, I must say. He's been extremely helpful to me in particular and to the industry overall. So I thank Joe for participating here again today. Joe and I have been doing joint sessions now for about 3 years, I think. So anyway, Joe's going to give you a little background to start off with, and then we're going to talk about the food safety plan, supplier verification. A lot of what you already heard from FDA today, we're going to kind of give it a little more of a bottled water spin as we go through it. And on that, I'm going to turn it right over to Joe to get us started on. He's going to give us some background information here.
Hello, everyone. Glad people stayed for the second session. I guess there's more to come for the afternoon, and that's good. Just to kind of set the stage again, and I'll try to do this quickly because Jenny already did some of this, and you'll see hopefully reinforcing overlap and not conflicting overlap. You'll tell me afterwards if it's not so. FSMA was signed by now over 4 years ago, with a proposed rule essentially in 2 years, a supplemental rule last year this time, and a final rule this September. So it's been a long time coming. I will add, as a small paid political announcement for IBWA, that IBWA commented each and every step of the way, and a lot of the comments that IBWA commented on did come up in the final rule, so that's very good. In terms of food industry-wide, there were, I would say, 10 major areas that FDA responded directly to industry comments. Most importantly, and Jenny said this, that the rules are flexible. They are not going to say that everything has to be a critical control point, but they are going to say that that preventive controls are broader than CCPs. Number two, they're going to provide a sliding scale, so that you provide the degree of monitoring, how often you monitor, how careful you are, how tight your limits are, depending on the nature of the control. So basically, you've got a lot of latitude to decide, this is what my food safety plan is. You'll hear me say over and over again, with flexibility comes responsibility to be able to defend what you do. But this is a program that does provide industry flexibility because there's so much the same rules apply across the whole food industry. What's good for bottled water isn't good for canned beans. And that's why it came out this way. Number three, there's a recognition that finished product testing, again, needs to be applied to the products. Here, bottled water is way out in front of everybody. There's so much finished product testing on bottled water. What's under the SOQs, I can virtually assure you, will be adequate to meet FSMA obligations. In terms of environmental testing, again, FDA is providing flexibility, is not expecting, as a general rule, to see testing of food contact surfaces, which, again, for other parts of the food industry, was a very contentious issue. Supply chain management does focus on both risk of the ingredients, but also what they call risk of the supplier, meaning history of the supplier, meaning if they got a good history, you don't have to do as much as if they're brand new or if they have a problematic history. Again, flexibility, right size your approach is the major theme. We talked FDA out of a few things. One is that electronic records requirements, which are pretty onerous, will not apply here. Number two is that, and I heard Jenny reference to that, there will be no advanced submission of what they call the facility profile, which is going to be a summary, essentially, of your food safety plan, and no remote access to records. If FDA wants to see your records, they have to come out to your facility and look at them there. They won't email you one day and say, send in your food safety plan. Number seven is that there is no requirement to review consumer complaints. FDA, I'm sure, will still ask you about consumer complaints, but they are not specifically addressed as a requirement. 8 third-party audits, and this was acknowledged in the FDA presentation, do not trigger the bells and whistles that we'll see in a regulation coming out in a couple of weeks, meaning for IBWA audits of interest here, there is no direct reporting to the FDA of serious findings, and so on and so forth. And again, Jenny acknowledged that here. So for us, that's very, very important. IBWA commented heavily on that. Number 9 is there is an exemption for preventive controls for warehouses with packaged food not exposed to the environment. Not exposed to the environment means it's in a container. So this would not apply to a carton of apples that's open, but it does apply to certainly all bottled water. And we don't get into refrigeration and freezing and that sort of thing. And finally, there are staggered compliance dates, which you'll see at the end. You already know a little bit, based on size of business, which is basically a 1-year, 2-year, 3-year timeline. Again, these were issues that there was essentially consensus throughout the food industry and that FDA really did. And I've said this a number of times, and I say it as many as I can. You know, I worked with FDA now for over 35 years, inside or outside, and I cannot think of another time where the final rule so reflected industry comments. Mike Taylor has said many times, and he really meant it, he wants a high bar for food safety, but he wants it to be workable for the food and beverage industry, and that's what they tried to accomplish. So the goals was right. Let's see how they did. Okay, now you got to pay close attention, records. There was a slide up there that when you get copies of your slides, I want you to all go home and circle that slide, which is all the areas in the regulation that lists all the records you have to take. Notwithstanding everything I just said, there are tons of requirements for record keeping, and FDA's inspections will heavily focus on records. So your record, you are what your records say you are. There was an old football coach that when he had a bad team had a bad record and they tried to explain it away, he said, no, you are what your record says you are. Well, here, you are what your records say you are. Your smile won't matter much. If your records show you're having problems and you're not correcting them, then FDA will pay attention to that. They will not pay attention to your warmth and camaraderie in showing them around the facility. So the records are very, very important, and you'll be hearing me say that again and again. Supply chain, and so what it means for your documents is if you didn't document it, it didn't happen. So if you want credit for making safe bottled water, you better show that you are doing it. The flip side, of course, is also true. If you did document it, that's how it happened. So don't document it in a sloppy way just because you have to document it. Document it truthfully and accurately so that it does reflect all you're doing. Supply chain management, we'll come back to. It's less of an issue with bottled water. And then finally, in terms of all the stuff that we're going to talk about, Bob's going to come up here in a second, I think, but this is your basic table of contents for what's in the regulation. You've got to have a hazard analysis. What are your basic hazards? What do we care about in bottled water? E. coli would be the major hazard. Identify and implement preventive controls. Have your HACCP plan. Identify where your controls are. 129 still applies, so that gets wrapped up into here. Number 3, apply oversight as needed, which means you have to monitor. You have to verify that what you did was done. You have to validate your process controls. We'll come back to validation. And you have to take good record of corrective actions. And again, the most important line here is document everything. And if you're not sure what everything means is, use your imagination. It means document everything. With that, I'm going to sit down for a couple of minutes. Bob is going to go through the guts of the food safety plan, and then I come up and talk back and talk about some of the other things.
Thank you, Joe. So I'm going to move through this relatively quickly to kind of make up a little bit of the time, but we'll go through the components of a food safety plan here, and as Joe said a little while ago, we're a bit of ahead of the curve here. I've been in meetings where other people in the food industry are still drawing blank stares and not really sure what this is all about, but we're ahead of it here. First part, you need to have a written hazard analysis, and there's a lot of detail in the final rule about this. And by the way, I'm going to be putting together a FSMA implementation guide for bottled water and so forth, so that should be published, hoping by December, before anybody has to comply. But we'll have a little more detail in that. Written preventive controls is required by the rule. Written supply chain program. We got some good answers out of FDA today. Thank you for asking those about particularly food contact packaging. There's been some back and forth about what exactly is covered by the supplier program, and I think they cleared that up for us. So that was a good point. The written recall plan. The written recall plan was not part of your HACCP plan in the past. It was just a separate plan that you had. It's now an integral part of your food safety plan. The written procedures for monitoring, the implementation, preventive controls, written corrective action procedures, and written verification procedures, and everything has to be documented. Not only the actual procedures themselves, but in many cases, documentation supporting your decision-making process through that development of those points. So the basic requirement for hazard analysis, identify and evaluate based on your experience. And FSMA does rely a lot on experience, okay? One of the things they're going to require is a preventive controls qualified individual in every plant. What they're looking for is assurance. One of the things they're looking for, at least, is assurance that the people who are running the plant, running the food safety program, are qualified to do so and have that knowledge base. So illness data, scientific reports, other information, known or reasonably foreseeable hazards for each type of food manufactured, processed, packed, or held at your facility to determine whether any hazards requiring a permanent control. So when you're looking at your food safety plan, first of all, there's a term that we'll have on a slide coming up called SOCOTA. And Joe probably knows this one backwards and forwards. He can probably spell it backwards and forwards, too, at this point. But it's basically serious or adverse health consequences or death to humans or animals. When you're talking about hazards to consider for your food safety plan under FSMA, you're looking for hazards that would qualify as a SOCOTA hazard. Okay? Not every single hazard needs to be addressed. Those hazards that are not serious or cause adverse health consequences or death are control points, perhaps, but they're not the type of hazard that your food safety plan is supposed to be focusing on. Okay, everything must be written, of course. So a couple of definitions, basic definitions here. A hazard is any biological and chemical, including radiological. When the rule was first proposed, they had radiological hazards as a separate hazard category. They've now incorporated it under chemical or physical agent that has the potential to cause illness or injury. And a known or reasonable foreseeable hazard is a biological, chemical, including radiological or physical hazard that is known to be or has potential to be associated with the facility or the food. Hazard requiring a preventive control. When you talk about preventive controls, you're only supposed to develop preventive controls for hazards that are more or less considered serious enough to be SOCOTA. Okay? So that's what you're working on, preventive controls for those types of hazards. So it's defined by FDA as a known or reasonable foreseeable hazard for which a person knowledgeable about the safe manufacturing, processing, packing, or holding of food would, based on the outcome of a hazard analysis, including an assessment of the severity of illness or injury, something else there. When you talk about hazards, you don't just have to identify a hazard. You need to consider its severity or the severity of any illness that might result or injury that might result from the hazard. That will occur in the absence of preventive controls. Establish one or more preventive controls to significantly minimize or prevent that hazard from occurring. They coined the term SMOP. So in your hazard assessment, obviously you're going to start out, you're going to need to do hazard identification as one of the first steps. And so biological, including microbiological hazards such as parasites, environmental pathogens, and other pathogens. In the bottled water industry, when you go through and you're developing your food safety program, your number one concern is going to be biological pathogens. I can tell you that right now. Of course, we have chemical pathogens, but once again, you're looking at what's the likelihood of that becoming a Sakota hazard? Minimal. So we're going to be focusing in this industry primarily on biological hazards. Chemical including radiological hazards, pesticide residues, drug residues, natural toxins, decomposition, unapproved food and color additives, and food allergens. Physical such as stones, glass, metal fragments. You see things like that every once in a while in a 5-gallon bottle, right? That comes back. But you need to consider that and how serious that is. Hazards may be naturally occurring or unintentionally introduced. Okay? Unintentional there is a key word. Because when you talk about hazards that are intentionally introduced, that's going to be covered under a different rule under FSMA. That's going to be the intentional adulteration rule. Okay? Hazards may be intentionally introduced for economic gain. Now, they call this economically motivated adulteration. It was originally proposed under the intentional adulteration rule, but when they received comments for it, they decided it's more of a CGMP issue when an employee intentionally introduces something to create damage for the company. So they moved it back under this particular rule here. Hazards identified must be evaluated to assess the severity of the illness or injury, which I just mentioned a minute ago. The probability that the hazard will occur in the absence of preventive controls. If there are no preventive controls established for that hazard, what is the probability that it will occur without preventive controls? Environmental pathogens must be evaluated whenever ready-to-eat food is exposed. Well, we're not technically a ready-to-eat food. We are, but we're not technically under the FDA definition. But environmental pathogens are monitored right now in our industry through containers and closures analysis. And in our comments on this rule we submitted to FDA, we told them we already have an environmental monitoring program in place. And that would be the containers and closures analysis. The other thing I bring up to audiences that I speak to as I travel around the country is, okay, one of the things we need to consider right now is the frequency with which we do containers and closures. Right now, that's what? Every 3 months, right, by the regulation. Is every 3 months going to suffice if we want to call this an environmental monitoring program? I'm not going to answer the question for you. I'm just saying we need to reconsider the frequency with which we do that. The regulatory requirement is every 3 months. But if you want to incorporate into your food safety plan that this is your environmental monitoring program, you may want to think about increasing the frequency. Hazard evaluation must consider the effect of the following on the safety of the finished food for the intended consumer, formulation of the food, condition, function, design of the facility and equipment, raw materials and ingredients, transportation practices. Just a footnote there, when the safe food transport rule comes out, we will probably see some impact on our industry with that rule, primarily for tanker transportation of bulk water. So be prepared for that. Manufacturing, processing procedures, packaging activities, and labeling activities, storage and distribution, intended or reasonably foreseeable use, and sanitation, including employee hygiene. And there will be other relevant factors, such as temporal nature of some hazards. Then you move into preventive controls in your food safety plan. You're going to need to identify and implement preventive controls to significantly minimize or prevent, SMOP, those hazards requiring a preventive control, i.e. make sure the food is not adulterated, does not contain any undeclared allergens. Interesting to note, one of the top reasons, because I get notices of just about every FDA recall that happens right now. If it's not the top reason for a recall right now, it's a very close second. Undeclared allergens, believe it or not, it's a really big thing right now in the food industry, and it results in a lot of foods being recalled. The other big category is organic foods. I see a few of those every week. PC, preventive controls, are those risk-based, reasonably appropriate procedures, emphasis on risk-based, because that's what the PC rule is all about. What is the real risk involved here? Reasonably appropriate procedures, practices and processes that a person knowledgeable about food safety, would employ to smop the hazards identified under the hazard analysis. Interestingly enough, your food safety plan is going to go beyond what your HACCP plan currently does. In your HACCP plan, you're primarily concerned with critical control points and the controls that you implement at those CCPs. Your food safety plan may go beyond that to control points. Okay, if you need to control or establish preventive controls at a control point, then that will be included in your food safety plan also. There are a number of different kinds of preventive controls described in the rule and in the preamble to it also. First kind is process controls, which is basically including as appropriate to the nature of the control and its role in the facility's food safety system, parameters, and the minimum and maximum value to which the parameter must be controlled. So the controls you have in place right now within your process itself are a form of preventive control. Food allergen controls, not really an issue for our industry. Sanitation controls, all of the checks you have in place for your sanitation program, including carryover measurement and so forth, those are forms of preventive controls too. Supply chain controls, if you're purchasing material from a supplier, and in our case I'll just use mineral salts as an example, are there any hazards associated with those mineral salts? If there are, who controls that hazard? Is it you, or is it your supplier that's supplying that material to you? Either way, you're going to have to address it in your food safety plan, either through a letter of guarantee if they're controlling it, or results of an audit or something. And if you're controlling it, of course, your records will document that. The recall plan is a preventive control, and I asked myself the question, why would a recall plan be a preventive control? And it actually addressed it in the preamble to the original proposed rule, and they said, because a recall plan, even though the hazard has manifested itself and may perhaps made some people sick, it prevents any further harm to public health. So therefore, it qualifies as a preventive control. And there will be other types of controls acceptable also. Now, there are also management components in the food safety plan. Preventive controls are subject to the following management components as appropriate to ensure the effectiveness of the preventive controls, taking into account the nature of the preventive control and its role in the food safety system. Monitoring is a management control, just applying new terminology here out of the rule. Corrective actions and corrections, and there are different definitions to those, which I think I'll address later. Verification and validation are also forms of management controls. Then you have monitoring requirements. Obviously, if you have preventive controls, you need to monitor whether or not they are effective. So you're going to establish and implement written procedures for monitoring preventive controls, including the frequency. Must be performed at an adequate frequency to ensure that the preventive controls are being performed consistently. Monitoring activities would be documented. We're kind of driving that into your heads. Everything needs to be documented. You need to have records for everything. Corrective actions. I said there were two different terms, corrective actions and corrections. Well, corrective actions are designed to establish and implement, you need to establish and implement corrective action procedures that to be used if preventive controls are not properly implemented as appropriate to the nature of the hazard. Procedures must address product testing and environmental monitoring results. So if your environmental monitoring or your routine product testing demonstrates that there's a preventive control that's not operating effectively, you need to have corrective actions to put in place, similar to under a HACCP plan. Now, corrections are defined as an action to identify and correct a problem without other actions associated with corrective action procedures. I knew Bill would love that one. I read that one. I had to read that one five or six times, too, to kind of understand what they were getting at. But corrections can be taken for sanitation and food allergen controls, but also for minor and isolated problems that do not directly impact food safety. So there you go. A corrective action is something that perhaps has an impact on the safety of the food, but a correction is something that does not necessarily have a direct impact on the safety of the food.
AKA, everybody, the big stuff and the little stuff.
There you go. Verification activities must include, as appropriate to the preventive control and its role in the facility's food safety plan, validation, verification that monitoring is being conducted, verify that appropriate decisions about corrective actions are being made, verification of implementation and effectiveness, and reanalysis. You know what? I'm going to move forward here. I'm going to have probably a separate workshop on verification and validation. I think it's necessary. Anybody else agree with that? You're real clear on verification versus validation? Because I read all 930 pages of this rule, and I'm still not real clear on it. So, testing. Now, this is something we're kind of unique at here in this industry, because we do a lot of testing on an annual basis, quarterly, monthly, weekly, whatever. A lot of the food industry does not. So, regulatory language is unchanged from the supplemental proposed rule. The food industry in large, in mass, really objected vehemently to having to do finished product testing. FDA did not remove the requirement completely, but they qualified it somewhat. Finished product testing is compliance with existing FDA requirements under the bottled water regulations, and that should meet all FSMA needs. So in other words, you know, when I submitted comments to FDA on this rule, I said, we do this, this, and this already. Please don't give us anything else. And that's what is happening here. Everything we currently do will satisfy the requirements of this rule. Environmental testing, cap and container testing probably will suffice, but companies need to be able to justify why the external environment will not infiltrate the closed system of the water filtration and filling. So in your food safety plan, you need to address why you do not need to do any additional environmental testing other than containers and closures. And I imagine IBWA is going to be helping you with that. Use of accredited laboratories is not required, and those labs do not need to send results to FDA. Also in the comments we submitted, I said we already use what FDA considers approved laboratories, and that's the phrase they use in the bottled water cGMPs. And I let them know we use programs like the US EPA Laboratory Accreditation Program for our approval. Big thing here is laboratories that do our testing are not going to have to submit results to FDA. And that may not seem like a big deal to you, but I used to work in the public drinking water industry. And when a certified laboratory does a sample of public drinking water and ends up with a result that exceeds Safe Drinking Water Act limits, that laboratory must report that to the state agency within 24 hours. They don't even necessarily need to notify you about it, but they still need to report to the state that there was a violation. So FDA is not going down that road. That should be a relief. Validation is a general requirement. Scientific and technical evidence that a control measure, combination of control measures, or the food safety plan as a whole, when properly implemented, is capable of effectively controlling the identified hazards. You do not need to validate food allergen controls. You don't need to validate sanitation controls. And I have some questions on that one I'm going to be submitting through their little question system, because we have a current conversation going on about sanitation. The recall plan does not need to be validated. Supply chain program. Now the preventive controls if you have written justification. Now, the plan itself is going to need to be reevaluated every 3 years, at least every 3 years. But there are going to be situations where you're going to need to reevaluate it sooner, particularly if you make process changes or you come across a new hazard you didn't anticipate, and you need to incorporate that into your food safety plan. So these are situations where the reanalysis would be required. And with that, I'm going to sit down for a few minutes and let Joe take over on supplier verification.
Are you going to have to answer questions at the end?
Yes, we will.
Thanks, Bob. I want to give you a little shifting from different voices. Let me just go back and reemphasize two things that Bob said that there's always a lot of confusion on. One relates direct to the supply verification, which is food packaging. Are there any food packaging companies here? I wouldn't think so.
I think there was earlier. But what
everybody's trying to say is you have to think, are you a buyer or a seller? If you're a seller of food packaging materials, nobody here is a seller, right? If you are a seller of food packaging materials, you are not subject to these FSMA rules. The FDA is not going to come and inspect you. However, if you are a buyer of food packaging materials, how many people here are a buyer of food packaging materials? Right. You have to be sure that they're doing a good job. Doing a good job does not mean complying with regulations they're not subject to. But doing a good job means they're using approved materials that go through FDA's food contact substance program and that they're providing them to you in a, you know, safe and suitable and sanitary way. So you get to come up with what your criteria are that they're good enough. But even though they're not subject to the rules, you're subject to being sure you're not putting something unsanitary in your system. And that is confusing to everybody, but we found that the buyer-seller thing kind of works. The second thing is validation versus verification. Validation is a one-time deal. It means how many people use something like ozone as a disinfectant in your bottling facility. Anybody here use ozone? Okay, a lot of people use ozone. Right. You use it, why? To disinfect. Validation means you have demonstrated that it does. That you are using the right amount of ozone for the right amount of time, and if you do that, it will create the level of disinfection you are seeking. So that's a one-time deal. Yes?
Well,
that is correct, and probably most people have not, and that's going to be a subject of a continuing discussion, I think, with NIBWA. How does the industry comply with that requirement? But the requirement is if you have a process control for a food safety purpose, and ozone would be, then that is supposed to be validated, right? And there will be lots of discussion at IBWA about what that means and how to do it, but that's what validation means. Verification means that you are following the procedures the way you're supposed to. So let's say that ozone says you're supposed to use so much for so long. You validate that works. Well, you actually do that on a regular basis. Are you measuring how much you actually are using? Are you doing for the right amount of time? That's verification. So the first is upfront, is the technology capable of doing what it's supposed to do? Versus verification, it's checking to be sure you're doing the right thing. Okay, I know I went over, but everybody is confused by that. Okay, I'm going to go through this really fast because I said for this industry, it's a big deal for the industry as a whole. It's not that big a deal for this industry, so let's go through it fast. Basically, what we're saying is that you have to decide if you are bringing materials into your facility, food packaging materials, salts, anything else you're bringing in, you have to be sure that those materials are safe and suitable for their use. That's what that means. It is now your job to be sure your supplier is doing a good job. You can't just let the government worry about them. The government basically is holding you responsible for their sins. So you've got to get out in front and be sure that they're doing a good job. That's what this whole thing is about. Right? So for bottled water, this is much more simplified. I mean, think of a pizza maker, right? A pizza maker's got to go out and figure out what the cheese guy is doing, what the pepper guy is doing, what the pepperoni guy is doing, what the onion guy is doing, what the spinach guy is doing. They got a lot of jobs to do on supplier verification. Be glad that we don't have a little bar water business, believe me, when you go read this regulation. So for us, it's much simpler. We have things like salts. We have the packaged materials I just talked about. And basically, do your suppliers have hazards that you have to worry about? You got to be sure they're doing a good job. And, of course, you have to what about it? You have to document it. You have to document it all because right, your records, you are what your records say you are. We'll repeat that two more times before I sit down, I guarantee you. So learn it. I find it works. Okay, that's a little fun here. Okay, if you are buying things from brokers, you can basically divide up the responsibilities of who's doing what, but ultimately you're going to be responsible. So if your broker is going to be responsible, you got to be sure that that's clear to everybody. Again, less of an issue in this industry, I think. Audit reports, we all care about audit reports because we're audited under the IBWA program. This really relates to if you do an audit of your supplier, are those audits available to FDA? And in that case, the answer is all you have to do is show you did an audit, and if there are any significant deficiencies, the corrective actions have been made. Logically, that's the most FDA will do anywhere else in the chain, but it was fought over that factual circumstance. This is just one of my lawyers in my group loves this slide, just because this is just the slide of the page in the Federal Register for the records associated only with supplier verification. You know, nobody here can read that. But if you count up how many lines, there are a lot. So again, be happy in this industry. We don't have very much on supplier verification, but you'll see similar lists for preventive controls and everything else. Very paper intensive. Okay, record keeping. How's that for a segue? All right. Now I'll slow down a little bit. These are records that basically show that what you're doing on a daily basis, you're doing it consistently. And when something doesn't go right, you attack that responsibly. And you correct anything and you document that. So first you're documenting that you're doing things well, and when you're finding out that you didn't, you go back and you fix it and you document that well. It's basically those two parts. Doing it well and documenting it and fixing it and documenting that. All right, you've got to keep them at least 2 years. They've got to be on site. And thankfully, you don't have to comply with regulations. You wouldn't be able to anyway. When FDA comes in, they can say that they want to copy the records. FDA is saying, they didn't say it today, but they're saying the other four, they're not going to copy records unless there's kind of an investigation aspect to it, meaning they think something's been going wrong. I'll believe that when I see it. I think there'll be routine copying of records. Old habits die young, believe me. When they go into a drug facility, they copy records, and so on and so forth. So we'll see. But nevertheless, they believe they are authorized to copy records, so you should expect that. That means they're subject to disclosure. So you that means if they do copy any records, be sure they're marked confidential or trade secret to show that you believe that they are your own records and should not be released to anybody else. We're going to do training. Should we take Henry's question quickly?
Very quickly, on the matter of records.
Yeah.
If you keep electronic records,
yeah.
Will they accept?
Yes, if you keep, okay, I jumped over electronic records. You are allowed to keep records either in hard copy or in paper. If you keep them electronically, you just have to let the inspectors sit down at the screen and look at them, and if they want to copy them, you press the little print button and you print them off for them.
Okay,
so you can definitely keep them electronically.
Right. Now, let's say those records are never written down in hand.
Right.
But you have a tablet and you go through your plant, you read all your monitoring systems, and you enter those into your format on your tablet.
Right. Yes. Okay, training, it's Bob's turn, and then I'll come back and do some close-ups.
One of my favorite topics, right? Training. According to the rule, all employees must be qualified individuals. This is what I was talking about earlier in terms of preventive controls, qualified individuals, PCQIs. Definitions changed a little bit in the final rule. It's now defined as more broadly as essentially to means. Oh, typo there. Yeah. That employees must be qualified to do their jobs. And FDA is very big on that. They need to know that there's a basic level of education for every employee in the facility. All employees must receive training. Each individual engaged in manufacturing, processing, packing, or holding food, or in the supervision thereof, must receive training in principles of food hygiene, food safety, including employee health and personal hygiene. That applies both the GMPs and PC part of the rule. And facilities, big surprise, must keep records. So this PCQI is now the term that's used for this particular individual that oversees all of this training within the facility. It's where a qualified individual is previously used, and a PCQI is a qualified individual who has successfully completed training in the development of risk-based preventive controls, at least equivalent to that received under a standardized curriculum, recognized as adequate by FDA, or is otherwise qualified through job experience. Must prepare or oversee certain preventive control functions. Now, this person, as I think FDA also went through, is responsible for preparing the food safety plan itself, validating preventive controls, review of the records, and reanalysis of the food safety plan. You all have somebody reviewing your daily records on a regular daily basis. Pete? Yep. Okay. Do you sign off on them? Okay. Signatures, initials, something, and a date. All right, that's the kind of stuff they're going to be looking for on everything.
Just note, I saw two hands go up.
Yeah.
In a room of 50 some odd people.
I'm making my own assumption quietly. something you'll need to do, and I'm not going to go through this because I already did, but this was just to describe the training process that FDA has in-house before they even get it to the external training. So our plan for training is I've already applied for and submitted my information to become a lead trainer under the Food Safety Preventive Controls Alliance. I talked to Bob Brackett out in Chicago last week. He runs the program. He spoke at the FDA public meeting last week, so I had a chance to talk with him directly. I think Joe Levitt put in a plug for me, too. I can't believe he said what he said, but anyway. lead trainers can certify preventive controls qualified individuals. What I see this as is an extension of the IBWA CPO program. If you're already a CPO, you would go through this additional training to become a PCQI. So the CPO would become the ground floor for the program, and if you wanted to become a PCQI, you could take the additional training that I would offer, which by the way, my curriculum has to be approved by FDA. It's ready to go whenever they want to see it. But that all has to be reviewed and approved by FDA also before I come out and train you. Good manufacturing practices, just very general. I'm not going to go through them because there's so many of them and so many changes. It's now housed in 21 CFR Part 117. It used to be in Part 110, but 117 is equally fun to read at night. Good sleeping material. It focuses on protection against allergen cross-contact, and the term cross-contact is used throughout the final rule. Anytime you see that term, it means allergen controls, that they've incorporated allergen controls throughout the CGMPs. Certain provisions containing recommendations have been deleted. A lot of things in the old rule, and quite frankly, I used to write regulations for the state of New Jersey, and when I first read the CGMP regulations under 110, I was really surprised to see recommendations, because regulations generally don't recommend anything. They require you to do something. So under 117 here, the new CGMPs, they've removed all of the recommendations. They're going to be moved to a guidance document that Jenny and Kathy talked about, and the rule is now sticking to you must do this, must do that. More of a regulatory regulation. The final rule, as I said, used the term allergen cross-contact. It's distinct from contamination. They don't say cross-contamination when it involves allergens. It's cross-contact. Training provisions apply to plants that are subject to the CGMPs, which is previously non-binding, but training is now a binding requirement, which is why we're going to go through with the whole PCQI program. Key preamble clarifications responsive to in the industry comments. Protection of food in outdoor bulk vessels does not apply to open containers for raw agricultural commodities. There's no zero tolerance standard for allergen controls. They're already exercising this, as I said a few minutes ago. Allergens, or presence of allergens, or suspected presence of allergens, or undeclared allergens are probably the biggest single reason for food recalls these days. FDA is really big on this. Recognize flexibility to use dry cleaning methods with no sanitizing steps. And Joe's back up for to talk a little bit about exemptions and then go into some closing comments too.
Okay, we're just about at the end, everybody. There are some exemptions. You notice on the list, bottled water is not listed, so we're not exempt. What we do have here, again, is storage facilities, warehouses are going to be exempt from preventive controls, and that's really what's going to apply to us. Now, and that's right here. There is also, let me go back here, didn't have time to put them in this presentation. If there are companies in the room whose business has less than $1 million annually, then there you get a break. That's the best way to put it. To get that break, you have to, number one, keep good records starting January of your annual sales. It's a three-year average. So 3 years from now, it won't help if you go back, gosh, I didn't know I had to keep those records. I threw them all out. So if that's you, you got to start January 1, being sure you're going to certify that you are less than $1 million. All right? If you are less than $1 million consistently over any given rolling three-year period, then you get to jump up for joy because these regulations do not apply to you with the same level of rigor they apply to the larger companies. What you have to do is two things. Number one, you have to submit something to FDA, I believe it's every year, that number one says you are a business that's under $1 million, and number two, that you fit one of two criteria. One is that you're such a good citizen that you are complying with preventive controls anyway. And you are documenting the marvelous system that you have in place. Or two, that you are in compliance with state or local regulations, which means if you've had a state or local inspection, you get that inspection report, which now is called gold, gold to you, because that's the, assuming it didn't say you failed your inspection, that's all you need to do. You certify to FDA that you are of the right size and that you maintain records that you either are complying with preventive controls, and of course you have all those records, or you've got your state or local inspection report. And so that is, shall we say, a streamlined version. So there are, I'm sure, a lot of small businesses within the bottled water community, and if you want to come up to me afterwards, we can talk more about that, because that is unique to you. That's the most important thing under exemptions. Warehouses, basically, storage of warehouses is not covered by preventive controls, and compliance dates. Okay, compliance dates is basically 1 year, 2 year, 3 years. 1 year, they somehow don't use the word large businesses. It is other than small and very small businesses. You know, come on. The statute didn't say the word large. And no one wanted to quibble if 501 is large. All right, it is. 501 employees is large. And as Jenny said, you have to go by your corporate family. And so if you are a company with 10 different facilities, each of which sells $900,000 worth a year, but times 10, that's $9 million a year, you're not a small facility. If you're one independently owned, et cetera, et cetera. I know there was a question about franchising, and I can't answer that here. But basically, large businesses 1 year, small businesses, which is 500 or below, 2 years. What they call qualified facilities, a very small business, 3 years, very simple. The part that's a little harder, but I just wouldn't worry about it right now, is for supplier verification. It's basically, number one, 18 months. And number two, if the company you are overseeing is smaller than you and they kick in later than you, then your obligation to oversee them coincides with their obligation to comply. But for now, right now, I was just thinking in terms of 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, and this rest of the stuff will pick itself up. Next steps. Bob, do you want to do that? Or want me to just run through it?
Go through it.
Okay. Next steps is, because this is repeating now, we want to try to finish. FDA is going to issue a bunch of guidance documents, and those will all be important, especially things on validation we've talked a little about, environmental monitoring. Also, somebody came up at the break and said that they're going to be doing something specific for beverages. So clearly that will be relevant to us too, not bottled water.
FDA, by the way. Right. CIPSAN is going to be doing a document specific to bottled water and other beverages. So we'll let you know when that's available.
Right. There are other final rules. Three have been sent to the Federal Register. Bob used to joke they'll come out the first day of the conference. They are, but because it's so thick, it takes 2 weeks to publish them. So you all get to go home. But by and large, you don't make fresh produce here, right? The third-party accreditation we've kind of talked about, and a supply chain for imports is basically the same as domestically. So we've really covered all this. In the spring, there'll be transportation and then food defense, and both of those do apply to this industry. Technical assistance, you've heard all about this from FDA, the new TAN line and so on and so forth, how to do that. Okay, conclusions. We've been talking about this now for a long time. Those of you that come to regular meetings, you've heard me talk about this so many times, you're sick of it. Well, it was okay to be sick of it last spring, but it's no longer okay now. Because the future is now, these are real, they are legal requirements, you are going to have to comply. And so this is what you really have to do. You do have to be sure that you are paying attention, get help from your association, from your own legal counsel, and there are four steps that I believe every company needs to take that is applied, that is applicable to. Number one, educate your leadership and your employees. This is a big deal. Number two, conduct what I call a gap analysis. You are on passive plans. You already are most of the way there. So don't think this is from zero. Your own HACCP programs that have served you well are going to serve you well here. What does your HACCP plan say? What are your gaps? They're largely going to be record keeping, number one, and validation, number two, are going to be your two biggest areas, I think, without question. Number three, you need to train for and implement what I call good record keeping practices. Why? Because you are what? Right, we're going to try that again. You are what you're
record-setting.
Right. And because of that, you got to be sure you're keeping good ones because we want them to reflect well upon you. And then finally, do a self-audit. Well, in the IBWA's case, you'll get your self-audit, I guess, whether you want it or not. And it's good that IBWA is doing that because that will help you.
Well, we encourage them to do it themselves, too, in-house.
Okay, well, that's good, too. That's good, too. Takeaways for bottled water. You're ahead of the curve because you've already got GMPs. You've already got standards of quality requirements. You've already got the IBWA code of practice. You've got a good foundation. Pay attention particularly to record keeping and validation and utilizing the checklists and the third-party audits as your dry run in preparation. The good news is that you can do this. The bad news is it will take you some time to spend and do this. But at least it's doable, it is achievable, and your association has been fighting for you for the last 4 years to make them doable and achievable. So thank you very much. We're happy to take questions. Oh, here's your checklist. That's all the stuff we've been talking about. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Regarding the preventative control qualified individual.
Yes.
Did I hear correctly that just because somebody is a CPO, that does not necessarily mean that they are a PCQI?
Okay, number one, I'm going to do a preliminary before we do it. FDA, for lack of a better phrase, screwed up the terminology.
Okay.
All right? It used to be the qualified individual is what you're asking. Now, the qualified individual is everybody who works there. Has to be qualified to do their job. If they clean bottles, they have to be qualified to clean bottles. All right. So now they have what they call the preventive controls qualified individual, what I have dubbed the super qualified individual. All right? And the super qualified individuals, whatever Bob Hurst says it is. Bob, why don't you answer that?
I didn't write the rule. Now, basically, to answer your question, it's a PCQI needs to be trained by a lead trainer, an FDA-certified lead trainer,
okay,
which is what I'm trying to achieve.
And the CPO does not do that.
And the CPO does not do that. Now, a lead trainer provides FDA-approved curriculum, okay? There's certain training materials that I will have to submit to FDA to get them to approve, specific to the preventive controls rule. And that's the curriculum I will then present to the group that I'm training to become PCQIs. So, yeah, I mean, basically, CPO would be here as a baseline, and the next step up would be PCQI.
Gotcha, but one does not substitute for the
exactly.
Other.
No, okay. PCQI is in addition to being a CPO.
And Bob referenced before, he did speak with Bob Brackett, and Bob Brackett heads up this new alliance. He also succeeded me as food safety director at the FDA. And I saw him last week, and I knew Bob had talked to him because he just mentioned that. I went up to Bob, and I said, Bob Brackett. I said, I know Bob Hurst talked to you about being recognized. And I said, basically, this is all you have to know. If you're not willing to recognize Bob Hurst as a super qualified individual trainer, then you might as well shut down your program. Because there's nobody else who can do it better.
So if you thought you were second hearing from me for the past 4 years, you ain't seen nothing yet, unfortunately.
But kidding aside, it is good for the industry to have Bob have that. And so all the seminars provided here will provide you with the necessary training so that your super qualified individual is truly super qualified.
Harry?
Can I answer that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I debate this with clients all the time.
Well, I knew what you're going to tell me already.
Go ahead. He just doesn't want to hear it.
Make it easy for him. All right? Put it in a binder. Be done with it. Otherwise, they're going to say, well, where's this part? Where's that part? You're going to have to bring him, spend all day bringing him to your different parts of your food safety plan. You got a year. Find the different parts. You're going to show him anyway. Put it in a binder. Is it not legally required? No, but it'll make your life a lot easier.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I have one.
Bob.
Earlier in the presentation, you talked about auditing your supplier. It was on that slide. And my question was, we're probably not qualified to audit our suppliers. How do we address that?
Well, the rule talks about the various ways of going about doing that or accomplishing that process, and they talk specifically about if you're not qualified to audit the facility yourself, then hire a third party to do it. Or if the supplier themselves gets audited annually, they either supply you with a copy of that audit report or get some kind of a letter of guarantee based on the results of the audit report.
Yeah, but Bob, I would argue that we're using your product, we should be able to audit them and say...
Well, yeah. I'm not saying you shouldn't audit them. What I'm saying is FDA provided options. They didn't just say you must audit your supplier. They also said, but if you're not capable of auditing your supplier, then do this, or this.
Right, right. The requirement is that you ensure that your supplier is doing a good job.
Whether you audit them or you...
Right. Who audits them is your decision.
Yeah.
But FDA has kind of fallen in love with auditing. Third-party auditing.
Because, quite frankly, I don't agree with what Dover just said. We buy the stuff from them. We're qualified to audit. Not if you're
outside.
Okay, John,
we settle it out there.
He's
I'm selling tickets.
He's probably qualified to do that, but most people, most bottlers and the number of water bottlers are not qualified to audit their supplier. They just don't have the technical expertise.
Right.
Because that audit is pretty defined.
Correct.
So don't try this at home.
Right.
So, Tom, don't try it at home.
Can I interject here? I would like to see that cage match. we can take bets on it, and the house money goes to Dwarf.
Yes.
Sounds like a plan. Any other questions? Steve? I'm sorry. Matt? Oh, you were first, weren't you? Yes, please. Go ahead. Yes.
Okay. I was just wondering, are we getting handouts on electronic format?
All you need to do is send me, I think the next slide is contact info. Yeah, there it is. Drop me an email, say that you'd like a copy of the slides. Be sure I name the presentation because I have copies of all the slide presentations. But just drop me a line and let me know that you want a copy of it.
Okay, so I understood that you had an option if you weren't auditing the supplier and that they would have to show other means of proving that they are following GMPs, they have the programs in place.
Right.
So if you have all that documentation from them via your approved supplier program requirements, then the audit is not a requirement.
That's correct. The audit is not a requirement. Again, the requirement is to be sure your suppliers are selling you safe and suitable materials.
But not necessarily via an audit.
Correct.
Right.
The requirement is that you assure they're doing a good job. If you choose to do it versus an audit, you can do it that way. You can do it through your own audit. You can do it through a third-party audit. You can instead review their records. You can test their products. You can get certifications. You get to choose how. In general, there simply is now a lot of interest in third-party certifications, and that seems like it's becoming the method of choice. Because if you're a supplier, you don't want to be audited 50 times by your 50 customers. You want to be able to produce a single third-party certification and send them to all you guys and say, look, I'm good.
I can arrange that.
Yeah. I knew it would build to a sales pitch.
There is a requirement that supplier be audited.
No, there is not. There is a requirement that you assure, that you have assurance that your suppliers are doing a good job. One way to achieve that is through an audit. What you're thinking, I'm talking about bottled water. There is a requirement if your supplier makes something that is subject to a class one level risk, a salmonella or a listeria. All right? If you've, bottled water doesn't have that. If you are one of those ingredients, you're buying cheese, for example, then there is a requirement to do an annual audit unless you can justify a less frequent audit, but there is a requirement for an audit if you have a class one level hazard. We generally don't have one for bottled water. I'm sorry, did that make sense to you? I'm seeing this. No, again, let's go over it. It is very confusing, and I know that. The requirement is that you assure yourself in a way that you can show the FDA that you did so, that your CAP suppliers are doing a good job. If you choose to do that through an audit, that's great. If you have another way to do it, that's okay too. Then that's subject to FDA saying that's a little too flimsy. I mean, it has to be something that somebody could find credible.
Well, isn't your quarterly testing a verification that they're giving us a good product?
Again, you get to put together your program, and testing is one of the ways that you can do that, yes. The answer is yes.
All right. One more question, because we have to move on here. I'm sorry. I'll back. Yeah, go ahead. You?
Yeah. You mentioned that the FDA is not required to provide consumer complaints, but on their presentation, it says they collect in consumer complaints for part of their knowledge database. So is it just going to be direct consumer complaints to their offices?
What happens on consumer complaints is consumers write into them. And when consumers write in them, they save them, and then they come up and check them out with you. So there is a parallel process for consumer complaints.
Yeah, consumer complaints can result in a for-cause inspection. It doesn't mean they're coming up to you asking you for your consumer complaint records. They're bringing complaints that they've received. Okay.
There is going to be a roundtable afterwards, and people have more questions.
Yeah, we're going to have a roundtable after the next presentation. So if you still have questions or things to discuss, we can certainly do it at that time. But I want to thank Joe for helping me out here, and we'll move on. We'll take about a 2 or 3 minute break, and then we'll come back and have another presentation.
Okay. Thank you all.